Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, on this planet, life is just about everywhere. Life finds a way, as they say. But that mantra implies a limitless relentlessness to the process. Evolution, though, is neither boundless nor random, according to our next guest. He is Simon Conway Morris. He's Emeritus Professor of Evolutionary Paleobiology at Cambridge University and author of From Extraterrestrials to Animal Minds, Six Myths of Evolution. He joins me now. Simon, welcome to the programme. I think, you know, evolution is one of those things that I think a lot of people misunderstand as a process. I'm wondering if you might just remind us very quickly how evolution works from a very basic point of view.
Well, thank you. There are two questions. I mean, first of all, do animals evolve? To which one says, of course they do, and indeed all sorts of other organisms. And then second of all, there's the question of what are the mechanisms which allow organisms, including ourselves, to evolve from preceding species. So we come from something which is not so dissimilar from a chimpanzee around about 7 million years ago. So Darwin argued that effectively it's a process of ever greater divergence, increasingly filling up the biosphere in more and more different forms. And his driving force, which was actually based, in fact, on artificial selection, was what he called natural selection. And since then, the world's moved on a great deal because many things which Darwin did not know, for instance, the structure of the genome and the possibility of actually selection working not only at the level of the individual, but perhaps at other levels as well, make evolution in one sense blindingly obvious and terribly straightforward. But in other ways, very, very complicated because, of course, there may be very many factors involved which lead to the end product, which is you and me talking to each other.
Hmm. And I suppose to sort of break it down, what the basic theory of evolution is that an organism will adapt over generations to its environment, not consciously, but rather through natural variations that happen, some of which are advantageous to that organism doing better in the environment. So if a bird is in a particular place where there are healthy treats deep in the ground, the ones with the longer beaks may survive better, thrive better, and of course replicate, and those genes will go on. And so that's a basic premise of evolution. Is that correct as you see it in this book?
Well, it's part of the story. I mean, to start with, of course, if one has a so-called adaptive advantage, then one's not too surprised to see that that part of the population which possesses, as you mentioned, a longer beak will do proportionally better. But it may well turn out that in other circumstances, one could imagine, of a counterfactor whereby the longer beak is actually more disadvantageous, for instance, working through the forests, getting caught in vegetation. So there are trade-offs all the time. But equally so, there's another factor, well, two factors. First of all, sometimes the environment changes rather dramatically, especially in a mass extinction. And therefore, one's going to ask, you know, where's the nearest bunker? And second of course, all organisms know about all other organisms. And this extends, for instance, to the bacteria in the guts of ourselves and other animals. So there's a symbiosis. And correspondingly, all organisms are, if you like, beholden to other organisms, or in other words, go the other direction and feed on them. So it's a huge network of interactions. And really the question is, how is this network held together? And what happens if it's allowed to diversify or correspondingly to shrink in size? What are the consequences of all that? So yes, your description of it in probing for deeper food in a nutshell must be correct. But there's a whole set of other factors which may contribute to the overall diversity of life.
We get a sense that it's sort of endless and limitless in a way, don't we? I mean, when you look at all of the different species, both macro and micro, that live on this planet, you get a sense that anything and everything can and will happen. Is that the case?
It is in one sense, in as much as my own view would be that even in comparison with maybe the world 100 million years ago, this biosphere is that much more interesting. It's more diverse, more complex, and involves many more complicated species which have, for instance, warm-bloodedness and bigger brains and that sort of thing. But added to that, though, is a striking occurrence of what we refer to as evolutionary convergence. In other words, although there are very many endpoints, one can think of a parrot and a palm tree as two examples, nevertheless, the totality of all possibilities may be much smaller than is sometimes thought to be the case. So we think back to Darwin's Origin of Species, and if you turn to the end of that volume, and I'm sure you've read it as closely as I have, there at the back is that one figure showing ever-diversifying forms, branching and branching and branching, with no sense that there's a limit to it. Whereas my view, which is shared by a number of other people, it's not simply a heresy, is that actually there are some very strong constraints on what can evolve on this planet and by implication on other planets.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't keep going bigger and bigger because of the, you know, the seven, I was going over this with my son in his science project, the seven sort of characteristics of life. Some of those would just be hugely challenged if you are as tall as a skyscraper.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there are all sorts of structural constraints. So we're not amazed to see that the skeleton of an elephant reflects the weight of the elephant, and correspondingly the size of the shrew reflects its own size. So yes, there's a constraint of gravity. If you live in water, then there's a constraint in terms of what we call a viscosity, very, very crudely, the stickiness of the water. If you want to swim at high speeds, you have that's the same way as a speedboat. You have really major trade-offs. It's energetically very, very expensive. And the same applies to flying. Hmm. So there are physical constraints. There are also chemical constraints. So, for example, if we look at what we call the periodic table, to the first approximation, the building block of life is carbon. And there's a pretty good reason to think that only carbon in the universe will be the suitable atom, the element. And so too, if we have the way in which energy is transferred within the cell, the currency is another element called phosphorus. And there's a very good argument that only phosphorus can do. So there, at a very, very basic level, there are major constraints on what can evolve.
Why carbon?
the reason for carbon, well, there are two things. The first is that it has an ability to make bonds all over the place. So it has four things which can link to everything else. So it's very good at making friends with oxygen and hydrogen and nitrogen. And if you do that, then you're on the way to making carbohydrates and making proteins and all the rest of it. There's a second trick, which actually goes back to cosmology, which is in stars, the basic element, of course, is hydrogen followed by helium. And thereby, the other elements are built up, I'm not going to go into all the ghastly details, in a sort of thermonuclear process. Now, in principle, actually making carbon is a rather tricky step as you move up the periodic table. But as Fred Hoyle showed many, many years ago, there's a very interesting, what's called a resonance, which actually allows carbon to be made with relative facility within the interior of the stars. When the stars blow up, the dust is scattered everywhere, coalesces into planets, and that's, in an essence, as people have often pointed out, we are stardust. We are the debris of ancient supernovae, and the carbon is the critical building block for us.
When I think of the amount of time that we have had living organisms on this planet, and I think of the diversity of all of that life that must have come from a last universal common ancestor, I kind of think, how is that possible in such a short space of time? Now, I know we're talking billions of years, but does evolution all sort of continue at a steady pace? And if so, is the maths right in terms of how much diversity, how many different adaptation species, environments, these organisms are changing over that period of time, and in so many different ways? Because, of course, you know, it's not just the physical things. There's things inside the cells. There's all sorts of change required to get this incredible world we see around us.
That's a very interesting point. In essence, we find that during the very, very long interval, which stretches more or less from when life originated, and I'm simplifying massively, which is what I'm an expert at, by the way, simplification, from around about maybe 3.5 billion years ago to around about 700 million years ago, life seems to be evolving relatively slowly, and it is principally what we call microbial, not just bacterial, but also relatively simple cells, sort of analogous to algae and things like that. And after that, things begin to accelerate. At least that's what the fossil record indicates. And we move in due course into what we call the Cambrian explosion. And it's this time, although animals have appeared before that, that they really seem to diversify extremely quickly. But there are a couple of things to add to this. So the first of all is that it may well be that what we need to make animals and similar organisms possible on this planet critically depend on what the chemistry of the ocean is like. So if the chemistry of the ocean is not propitious for the evolution of animals, they're never going to appear. If the chemistry of the oceans changes in various ways, especially linked perhaps to oxygen, then the opportunity is provided. And the second trick, which I think is slightly underappreciated in regards to evolution, and it's worth reminding those people who are, if you like, suspicious of evolution, feel somehow that it might sort of it makes them uneasy in one way or another.
I don't think that those people exist.
Oh,
I really don't. I think people willfully choose to disbelieve in evolution. I don't think anybody, if you sit them down and you honestly say, look, here's what you're suggesting. I don't think anyone actually believes that. I think people believe it as a sort of badge wearing. I don't know, personally, I'm sure we get a load of texts in people saying, I absolutely don't believe in evolution. Let me know why, given everything we know. Please do let me know why. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. Please continue, Simon.
I have met people like that and so forth. And I respect them as people, so I certainly certainly not dispute that. But the other point I was going to make is that with regard to how organisms, if you like, assemble themselves, the thing which is quite often forgotten is that a good part of what we might call the heavy lifting in evolution is achieved long before the complex structure itself evolves. So to give a rather nice example, in my opinion, our eyes are transparent, and the reason for that in part is because we've got lenses. The lenses are made of protein. And again, if you actually think, I have to qualify slightly, because half one of my eyes looking at you actually has got a plastic lens in it because I had a cataract. But otherwise, the lenses themselves are made of proteins, which by and large are fantastically stable, because until the cataracts develop, I can see clearly for 70 years. It's amazing. However, the proteins which are employed to make the lenses are actually derived ultimately from microbial forms. They are actually originally evolved for the process of actually stress resistance in various sorts of bacteria. Again, I simplify slightly. And that comes as no surprise, because if you want a lens which has got certain properties which allow the light to be transmitted through it, but also to be as stable as possible, then you're going to choose these rather small proteins. And the reason we call them crystallines is, as the name suggests, that they allow the light. But those proteins come from a distant ancestor. They weren't invented by the animals. They've been recruited.
But like 700 million years to develop something as incredibly detailed as an eyeball, it just seems like not long enough. How do you say, for example, if we go back to the moment before eyes could give us vision, but they were proteins that were, you know, as you say, responding for stress response. Why would they be advantageous before they give us vision? And until they give us vision, how have you evolved those bits before that?
Well,
I'm sounding like one of those people I don't believe are out there now.
Well, effectively, it is because those compounds, which are often proteins, are actually being employed for a completely different set of purposes. And in the case of our crystallines in our eyes, they're actually originally involved with what's called heat shock in certain cases. So in other words, they help to protect the organism from a sudden environmental change. So they're recruited to a function which turns out to be necessary to make a lens. That is, it's got to be water soluble, and it's also got to be quite small. The other thing, two things. First of all, actually, eyes are not unique to animals. They've actually evolved independently. And one of my favorite examples is there's a tiny marine alga. Technical name is a dinoflagellate. And on the side of this single cell, there's basically a tiny eye, which has something in terms of its structure, which is really quite similar to our eyes.
What?
So there we go. And if you'd like to know a bit more about this, the actual lens itself is actually derived from what we call a chloroplast, which is otherwise used to trap sunlight in algae and in plants. But here it has been taken over to provide an alternative function. So, you know, the point about evolution in one way is it has this astonishing versatility. So you can step back from all this and not worry too much about, you know, exactly where that form is, but to say, what do you need to achieve? Do you want to focus light? Do you want to have transparent tissue? I'll do it for you. I can do it this way. I can do it that way. So don't be surprised if it turns up in a single-celled alga as it does in an animal.
Wow.
There we are.
Let's talk about the effects of major events then on evolution, because there's this idea that these moments in time, ice ages or the asteroid, are sort of moments that lead to a rapid diversification of life because they squeeze and change the atmosphere so much. Is that true?
It's true to an extent, in as much as there are these so-called mass extinctions, and the most famous is the one which led to the demise of the dinosaurs, and that was probably principally driven by an impact of an asteroid, actually in a location near Mexico, in fact, in Yucatan. But also reinforced by enormous volcanism on the other side of the planet in an area which we now identify as India. And in combination, this seems to have led to a major biological crisis. And indeed, as I mentioned, the disappearance of dinosaurs. After that, the dinosaurs are gone, and the mammals, which are poised, if you like, suddenly take over the world in a pretty rapid fashion, though it takes maybe 50 million years to encourage something looking like a dog to go into the water and turn itself into a whale. So none of this is instantaneous. But on the other hand, my own view is that although the orthodoxy, which I don't approve of at all, is that mass extinctions radically redirect the course of evolution. In other words, it's a contingent event which has no predictability about it. It's just bad luck at the time. I would argue, actually, paradoxically, mass extinctions are, in fact, although on the day, deeply destructive and unpleasant and to be avoided, in the long term, are actually creative. The reason for this is that although the dinosaurs are enjoying themselves enormously in the Cretaceous, in point of fact, the group we belong to, the mammals, is already beginning to diversify. They're already there waiting in the wings. So the mass extinction does indeed give them the opportunity to radiate. But because mammals, all things being equal, are more interesting than reptiles, I'm sorry to the herpetologists, but that's the way it is. They're socially more adept. They have warm-bloodedness. They have larger brains. Birds and mammals independently have evolved tool-making. Then sooner or later, my view, if the mass extinction hadn't happened, then in the good old Darwinian way, chipping away at the edifice of dinosaur supremacy, ultimately the writing on the wall would have been for the dinosaurs. But the mass extinction brings everything ahead of schedule by maybe 50 million years.
So what you're suggesting, and I wonder very quickly if you had any evidence for this, is that mammals were always going to win out over dinosaurs, but the asteroid just speeded that up?
That's pretty much my argument. Of course, one's got to recall that amongst the dinosaurs, there's one group, they're called the theropod dinosaurs, and some of them became very, very small. Before they took to the air, they already had feathers. Therefore, they were pre-adapted to take to the air. So the birds themselves were also part of the ingredient. But even so, yes, that's absolutely right. The birds and the mammals would have taken over the world sooner or later. Give me the mass extinction. I'm most grateful because, in fact, that gives you the opportunity to shave away tens of millions of years. And if the counterfactual world where the asteroid had missed, the volcanoes didn't explode, what would have happened? Well, you mentioned in passing ice ages, in a steadily refrigerating planet, which is what was happening after the end of the Cretaceous, as we now define it, the polar caps, first in Antarctica, later in the North Pole, grow and grow and grow. Temperate and polar regions are places where warm-blooded birds and mammals can do very nicely indeed, thank you, but not the sort of places where relatively cold-blooded reptiles can manage.
I see. Okay, very interesting. Well, if you'd like to learn more about the many myths of evolution, we kind of covered just a couple of them. Simon Conway Morris's book is called From Extraterrestrials to Animal Minds, Six Myths of Evolution. Simon, thank you very much for your time.
My great pleasure. Thank you ever so much.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.